I wanted to just start off by asking you about, you've got a pretty unique history. So you came from Africa, actually, when you were really young here. Can you kind of just describe it?
Sure. I moved to the States when I was 5 years old. My parents, my family is originally from Ethiopia. It's the eastern part of Africa. And we had to flee because my father was involved just at a very low kind of entry level position in the Ethiopian government at the time of a political uprising. And so he didn't feel safe there and was really inspired to get out as quickly as possible. So we were part of a wave of Ethiopian refugees that were pulled out of Africa and sought refuge in Germany in the late 70s. And then it took a long time for us to secure or be certain of permanent residency and that status in Germany. So my father, while waiting in Germany for that kind of decision to be made, also sought asylum in the U.S. and that paperwork processed pretty quickly. So we got to come to the States when I was really young.
Did you go straight to Grand Rapids?
Straight to Oklahoma.
Oklahoma?
Yes, of all places. So in 1982, we come to Oklahoma. We had a few options, but I believe that the sticking point for Oklahoma was that we had a distant cousin who had already immigrated and was living in Oklahoma. So that was kind of a sense of stability. And then also in Germany, we attended a Protestant church that had a sister kind of relationship with a church in Oklahoma. So we were able to rule out other states because we felt like we had a couple of things going for us if we went to Oklahoma.
What do you remember about growing up in America? Was it that much of a change for you, or were you here so early that it didn't feel that different for you?
You know, I have some specific memories, and I think what's clear in my mind is just the sense of culture shock, because suddenly people don't look like you, and suddenly people don't sound like you. I mean, Germany is clearly quite homogenous as a society, so we're already used to that, but there was still a small contingent of Ethiopian people that had come over with us, so we felt like we had a bit of an extended family in Germany. But when we moved to Oklahoma, it turned out that we really didn't know that cousin that well and didn't have a lot of opportunities to interface with him. So it really was just, you know, this kind of sudden submersion into this society and this community that we didn't know how to navigate at all. So I think I remember feeling out of place in elementary school and really not understanding anything and just being really focused on learning the language as quickly as possible.
I'm curious. I feel like a lot of people who are comics, they often talk about like being an outsider as a child and having to use humor as a way to almost like adapt to their situation. Was that a lot of what happened with you?
I think so. We had some just interesting things happen to us that I believe happened to a lot of Americans or people in general. Divorce, for example, when we didn't expect that. And just changes, you know, like economically, like our family was really poor. So those different things kind of coming at you with no real control when you're a child, you have a couple of options in terms of how to overcome it. And I do think that I was one of three children growing up in my household, and we tended to try to understand it with a humorous approach and just laugh at it if we could.
Do you remember joking about this stuff? And in what way would you?
Oh, that's a good question. I think I remember things like my brother feeling really frustrated because we couldn't have certain things that we thought were basic. And so I would have my oldest brother kind of help us rationalize that by saying, well, at least we have like one of these two choices when you realize that we probably shouldn't have had any choices in the first place. So it's that kind of rationalization, knowing that if we were still in Africa, for example, we wouldn't even have the opportunity to make those kinds of choices. So I think in some ways it's a little bit of a dark sense of humor, but that's kind of how we dealt with it.
Yeah. How did your humor develop through high school and even into your adulthood? Did you know you were a funny person?
I knew I was a funny person. I knew that I had a sarcastic side because people would just say that, you know, Nardo, she'll say whatever we're thinking. So I had a sense of myself being funny, but I never imagined that I would get on stage and share those thoughts out loud by any means. So that was kind of new for me.
Yeah, and can you take, you kind of have, I think, this little bit of a well-known story of how you ended up on stage, but can you talk about how you first ended up on stage with your stories and your humor?
Sure. I think the story is there were a couple of motivating factors, but in one case, I was working in my career. I'm in an administrative position at a hospital, and I recognized that as I was recently promoted, I was getting opportunities to do public speaking, and I hated it. I really wanted to be the worker bee behind the scenes, and I was more than happy to put in the effort and let someone else present and share the story of the work that we'd done. So recognizing how anxious I became, regardless of, you know, the preparation that I put into all of it, I still had to find a way to get over that. And I reached out to one of my uplines or my bosses and asked for some advice as to how she does it so well. She gave me a little guidance, but had at least suggested that I reach out to other people that do it well. And I just didn't see myself kind of doing that. So I put that responsibility on myself to find a way to overcome that fear of public speaking. And I thought about the options that were available and known to me. I mean, you've heard of like Toastmasters, you've heard of the Dale Carnegie program. They were all only available during the day, so that would always conflict with my work schedule. And they didn't also feel really natural to me. I didn't know that I wanted to be in a sea or a room full of strangers and try to face this with a group of people that I didn't necessarily trust either. So I just kept thinking about other options. And my husband and I have always been fans of comedy, and we'd been to a comedy club downtown, Dr. Grin's and the Bob, and we were aware of an open mic night that they held there and thought about that opportunity. And I know it wouldn't make sense to anyone else, but I just remember looking back, there were many people that got on stage for 3 minutes to say whatever they wanted, and they weren't always funny, but they sure had presence and they sure had confidence. And I just remember thinking, man, if I could do that, which I can't imagine doing right now, but if I could do that, then I would be completely improved and comfortable in front of my peers and a room full of colleagues. So that's an option. And the benefit of doing an open mic is that it's at night when my kids are asleep and my husband won't mind, you know, being at home. So that was just a new direction for me.
What was the first show like for you?
Terrifying. So, Robbie, I sent out an email making a request of stage time at this place that I'd never ever set foot on stage before. And I thought that it would kind of just go into an abyss and I'd never hear back from them. But immediately, Stu McAllister, he's the MC for Dr. Grin's, reached out truly 30 seconds after I sent that email and said, here's your date. It's December 2nd. I'll see you soon. You've got 3 minutes. And I thought, oh my gosh, that's easier than I thought it would be. So I panicked. I walked from one room to the next and told my husband what I was doing. And he turned off the television and looked at me to say, what? What are you really doing? I can't imagine this for you. I'm really suddenly afraid for you. So I thought that I would have to work on jokes. And clearly that was my next step. And he said, what jokes? You don't have any jokes. What are we going to do? And I appreciated that it became this team approach and that we would have to figure it out together. I then responded to that email and said, thanks for the time. What do you suggest I do? And he had said, you got to get on stage. There's no other way to practice this. So my first real time on stage, and this is a really long way around it, but was at a different restaurant or bar in town. And I got up on stage. I had 5 minutes there. It was Halloween night. It was really surreal because everybody was in costume. but I hadn't dressed up and I was just really terrified. And I survived it. I did 5 minutes. Some of my jokes went over well. Clearly, I was very nervous. And I did it, though. I had accomplished this goal.
What did you write about in terms of your jokes when you started?
Yeah, so I remember starting with a few jokes about the things that I feel like I deal with maybe more than once in my life. And they were things like my name, Nardos, is really unusual. So how have I dealt with that growing up or as an adult? And then I started thinking about other things like just being married and what that experience is like, my expectations and my reality. I thought about things around being a mother and raising children, and it just started to come together that way. And then I also worked on my ethnicity a little bit and spent some time telling stories about that. And I remember writing a few jokes, sharing them with my husband and saying, is this funny? And he would say, no. And I said, how about this? Is this funny? And he said, no. And I said, is this funny? And he said, kind of. And so I thought, okay, this is going to be helpful because I've got an honest critic that will tell me what I should work on and what I should throw out. So I did that. That was my approach.
Do you remember the jokes that he initially said, oh, this one might work?
Oh, man. I don't. I have them probably in a folder that's tucked away in a box in the basement, but I think they were just initial ideas and stabs at thinking that certain concepts were humorous, and he just didn't see the connection at all. And so I had to appreciate that, because what I wanted from people was laughter and not, you know, the same kind of inquisitive look. So
what made you keep doing it? Because obviously you had this one approach of, you were like, if I can get on stage and have the confidence, then I'll be fine. But what made you keep going after that first one?
So I did it. I did it that first time, and I was really glad. I always knew that once was not going to be enough, that practice would, you know, to some degree make me perfect as far as that goal. But I went home. I was really happy, just relieved to have gotten through it. And then my husband was really positive and supportive of all of it. And I saw an email that evening before I went to bed, and it was Stu McAllister, the guy that had signed me up for the December date. And he said, I was at the show. I saw you. You did a great job. He said, keep working on it. Clearly you're new, but don't stop. And that inspired me, because I felt like if someone who's seen a lot of comics start and develop over time thinks that I should continue to do this, then maybe it's worth it for me to continue to explore.
Did you initially like doing it, or did that take a little bit of time?
I liked doing it. I was very nervous for, I would say, 6 to 9 months. And every new time I got on stage, in terms of the room, having never been there before, I could never shake the nervous feeling that I had. But if I had been on stage in a certain room more than once, then it became easier for me. And I recognized that improvement, which made me enjoy the experience, because really that was my goal, was to become more comfortable with all of that. So I liked it. I loved getting the laugh. There was nothing like that. And I remember trying different types of jokes, trying some kind of darker jokes and some easier jokes that I think everyone could relate with. And seeing who would laugh was really interesting to me, because the comics tend to sit in the very back. And if you hear that distant laughter, you understand that you've told maybe something a little bit more creative or dark that only a comic would understand or appreciate. And if you've told something that's a little bit lighter and universal, then you hear the crowd laughing in the front. So that was interesting to me.
Yeah, it was interesting. I went and watched a few of your videos.
Oh,
and
really?
Yeah,
oh,
yeah.
No!
I have to do some research, yeah, of course. Yeah. So I went and I watched a few, and it's interesting to like see your humor. And I think this was probably back before you actually had your show that you were doing at this point. But so much of it, even back then, it seemed like was very personal to you and was about your background and your ethnicity. And was that something that was very natural for you to do? Was that the stuff that was getting the response?
Yeah, that's interesting that you say that, Robbie. I remember asking the first comic, Stu, what I should do. How do you decide what to say and what jokes to start writing? And he had said, be original, be yourself. The more you do that, you'll never have to worry about people stealing your material, because they can't be as specific as you without people realizing that's a total ripoff. And it's genuine. That's what comes across as relatable or appreciative to the crowd. So I think that's where I started, and I've kind of stayed there, because I feel like comics talk about what's a hacky joke or a hacky premise. It's something that's been done so many times that it feels like anyone could write that joke. And I think the more personal you get, the more interesting it is, and the less likely anyone has thought of saying it yet, but has maybe had it in their mind, but you've put it down on paper and shared it with the crowd.
Is it easy to find humor in those things for you?
It is. For some reason, it is. And I don't know if it's because of just who I am and what I feel like I've had to face and the approach that I've had to take. But it is easy to see humor in dark moments for me. It's just my approach. I don't know. I always go there.
Is it a a scary thing to then show that to an audience, though, and to present such personal things to an audience?
Definitely. And I think there are insecurities that you can't always expect coming out, even if you're trying to control them. For example, maybe you hear people say that women can't be funny, or you hear people think, well, if you have a strong opinion, then you might come across as an angry black female, for example, or all she's going to talk about because she's a woman is her period, you know, just something that's really stereotypical. So you sit there thinking on stage, just as you go up, I don't know what they're expecting, so I'm just going to be myself. And I feel like, again, if you just stay true to yourself, then you worry less about what other people are going to say, and you really focus on what's funny. So that works for me.
Yeah. At what point did you decide to go, let's turn this into an actual one-woman show?
Yeah. So I started stand-up December of 2012, I want to say. And once I realized that I really enjoyed it, I had kind of met my personal obligation of doing it for a year to get good at public speaking. I thought that I should set new goals every year so that I continue to grow in some way. And I didn't know what I was going to do about 9 months ago. I just remember thinking, Nardos, you've done 30 minutes in front of crowds. Now you're the feature for a few different rooms whenever you're asked to do things. You're getting paid for your work, which is great in terms of an accomplishment. But what's next? And I remember thinking it would be wonderful if I could show to people that I'm a draw to some degree, that I'm a reason to look forward to a show, and that my name is important. Because, you know, I've set myself apart from the others, but also that I can do more than 30 minutes of time on stage. So I think my future goal ultimately is to be a headliner. And that is a comic who can say confidently, I have 45 minutes to an hour of time on stage. So I thought, it's going to be hard for anyone to give this to me. I kind of have to create this opportunity myself.
So putting together the show, obviously you wanted to put together enough material to support that, but did you feel like you had a story to tell as well that you wanted to tell?
I did, Robbie. And I remember thinking, okay, so one other thing that inspired me was the show, the Broadway hit, 700 Sundays. It's Billy Crystal's story. It's the story of his life, and it's fascinating. It's very entertaining, and it's about 2 hours long. And I remember watching it. It was on Showtime. They had produced it for him. And it was great. So I remember thinking, what story could I tell? And how could I do that? Because he did it so artfully. I'll never kind of, you know, meet that measure. But personally, it would be wonderful to be on stage and have a one-woman show. Then I thought, what would you say? And I looked back, and kind of what you'd noticed about the material that I've done in the past is that it's personal. And I thought, maybe people would enjoy understanding the background for this material. So what if they knew where I was coming from? Would they laugh a little bit more easily? Would they feel less conflicted about what I'm saying, where race matters or where gender matters or where culture clashes matter? So I decided over time that what I would write is a one-woman show, that it would have two parts. And the first part would be the story of my life, because people have said they think it's an interesting one. And I've never thought it was an interesting one. I figure everyone just has, you know, some story to tell, and mine's not that unique aside from the fact that I'm an immigrant, but who isn't really if you go back far enough? So I thought I would tell the story of my life, and then the second part of my one-woman show would be me telling jokes in a sequence that correlates with the story of my life.
And so people being able to really understand where you're coming from, they can more directly then connect with the jokes of the second half of your show?
Yes, that's the goal. So that was like my hypothesis, is if you knew me better, or if you knew me as well as my friends and family, would you like me more without knowing me that well? But now you know more about me in a short time.
Has the hypothesis been answered? Do you think has it worked?
I can't say that I've proven it yet. So February 20th was my premiere. I did two performances that night, and mostly my friends and family came out. They loved it. They really enjoyed it. They supported me incredibly. And a lot of comics that I know. So obviously they're my friends. But the feedback from those experiences was, I never knew that about you. That's so interesting. And we really enjoyed it. But then there was also a contingency of comics who said, you know what? Your jokes are so much richer because I know now what happened to lead you to telling the story in a funny way. So people said that it connected really well. But then I did it during Laugh Fest around mid-March. And that was a wonderful experience. It was in a really large auditorium, so it was kind of hard for me to hear the feedback because the other performances were in a smaller theater. It was a wonderful experience, and I'm so grateful for it. But it was interesting because more strangers showed up, people that heard about it in the community because Laugh Fest had done a really nice job promoting it. And the thing that was interesting about that is I heard more people taking it seriously and more somber notes as far as the stories that I told, that when I told the jokes, they still didn't necessarily let go. They didn't just laugh. So it was interesting. I think that people enjoyed it, but I think they had the story of the immigrant and the sense of those challenges that people face when they're out of place and trying to fit in. They took those stories to heart and they felt kind of sad for me rather than, oh, this is funny. She's laughing, so I'm laughing.
That's tough, I feel like, to get that balance right.
You're right. Yeah. You're right. So I'll keep doing it, hoping to hit the right note. But I think that's what you get with crowds, too, when you do stand-up in general. If you're one of 10 comics in a lineup and you get up there and you tell your story, there are going to be people that think it's hilarious, and there will be people that don't get it. So I think that's just a gamble you always take.
Yeah. I also wanted to see, can you give me an example of how you would, like, set up a joke in the first half of an act and then have it almost pay off in the second half of your act?
Well, then no one's going to come to my show.
Just one joke.
Okay, so there's a part in the first act, and we'll see if this meets your needs, but there's a part in the first act where I'm talking about a time in my life when I was really young when my father was unemployed. My mother has left, and so my brothers and my dad are all that's left, and my dad's the only person that we can lean on for everything, and he decides to quit his job. So now we feel like we're, completely screwed and have no opportunities as far as going forward and having the things that we need. So with all of that in place, my dad just goes through a series of kind of just selfish encounters to meet his needs, and I think clearly he was depressed at the time and feeling also like he didn't have a lot of options. But telling that story and telling the story of what my brothers and I had to kind of do to be a little bit more independent then leads to the second act where I tell a joke. This is the joke if you want to hear it. Growing up, we were really broke. I remember my dad would just spend hours just filling the space of our government housing with his expert nonstop whistling. He would brag about how great he whistled. And the only thought that ever occurred to me was, how about a full-time job? Could you get great at that? Because I'm pretty sure it's whistle while you work and not instead.
That's great. That's so good. Oh, I love that. Yeah.
So, it really happened. There were these just strange long stretches growing up where my dad wouldn't work, and we just looked at each other and thought, he's suggesting that this is a relief to him and this is more of a stress-free life, and we're feeling more stressed out. So how is this gap going on? It's just interesting.
Oh, I love that. I love okay. that. Yeah. No, that totally works. Yeah. Okay. So I had a couple more questions for you to ask, and these are a little more like philosophical. Okay. So I want to see what you think. So you talked in an interview with Review Magazine a few years ago or a few months ago about your father telling you as a child to hold on to your culture and values from Africa.
Yeah.
Do you think African is a part of a way to do that for you?
I think so. I think in some ways African is a bit of an explanation to people, to Ethiopians that I don't necessarily connect with because I don't have all of my culture intact, and also an explanation to Americans why I am the way that I am. And it's a little bit permission to myself to accept who I am, because I've had to make changes and deviate from, I think, a cultural path and expectation that was set in front for me.
In that same interview, you talk about like preserving that culture and showing that experience to your daughters as well, and that you wanted to do that.
Yeah.
Have they watched African, and is that a way to do that for them as well?
My girls, I love them. They have heard me rehearse African, and they don't completely understand what's going on, but they think it's cool that I'm doing it, and they've been great cheerleaders. I really struggle with that one, because I think that ultimately they're truly Americanized girls, and their ethnicity, as far as identifying with their Ethiopian side, is a missing piece, because I'm not close with my side of the family. Mm-hmm. And I think it will be important, and my husband and I have always had intentions as they get older to take them back to Ethiopia and to show them where they came from, as far as my side of the family is concerned. But yeah, I think that it's been hard to share with them.
Do you hope that in a couple of years when they're older, you can at least like tell these same stories to them that you're telling now as a way to show them what you went through?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think even now, as they've been growing up, I've explained, you know, who they are and where we come from. So they understand, and they know their grandparents. They know my folks, but they have questions that I don't think that they always understand the answers to. But I think that the more we continue the dialogue, the better their understanding will be.
Mm-hmm. Well, Nardis, do you have anything else you wanted to add?
No, I'm really excited about my show in Kalamazoo. I feel really fortunate, because this entire experience has just reminded me of how many great friends I have, and what incredible support there is in our community, because I never dreamed that I would have done this more than once, which would have been just for myself. So.
All right. Well, Nardis, thanks so much.
Yeah. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. And nice meeting you.
Yeah.